produced and distributed by the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws in Washington, D.C., this is your normal daily audio stash, The Growing Truth About Cannabis. Welcome to the most popular podcast regarding marijuana in all of America and all the world, featuring interviews with scientists, politicians, doctors, prohibition policy activists, regular cannabis consumers, musicians, artists, and Normal staff and Normal's board of directors, along with music and comedy no other podcast can offer. You can always find out more about the show at our website, stash.normal.org, and continue the education and conversation on our blog as well. We're ending marijuana prohibition with education, one listener at a time. The podcasting and blogging technology for the Normal Daily Audio Stash is provided by Red Aphid Interactive Media. Visit www.redaphid.com. It's Thursday, May 1st, and it's 4:20 somewhere in the world. I'm your host, Radical Russ Belville, and this is your Normal Daily Audio Stash. Today is May Day, also known as International Workers' Day. We call on labor organizations worldwide to stand up for workers' privacy and beat back the scourge of suspicionless and pre-employment drug testing of workers. Drug testing without probable cause essentially means that you're assumed to be guilty of a crime until you can prove yourself innocent. It means that while the government is constitutionally restricted from unreasonable searches of your person without warrant, your employer may treat you like property. Workers of the world, unite! Now, today on the Daily Audio Stash, we're speaking with Rick Doblin from the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies, or MAPS. We'll be discussing the life and legacy of Albert Hofmann, the father of LSD, who passed away at age 102 this week. Cannabis Carrie is back with some more fantastic reggae. This time we've got Carlton Livingston and his song 100 Pound Collie Weed. I and I love this track, mon. I hate it when she makes me do that. Then we'll speak with Nicholas Van Dam, a doctoral candidate in psychology at State University of New York. Nicholas has just published a paper in the journal Human Psychopharmacology examining the studies of cannabis in schizotypal syndromes and how those studies are misrepresenting cannabis's role by ignoring the use of other drugs. We've got a lot to cover, so sit back and relax with a tasty beverage and your favorite strain and enjoy your normal daily audio stash. Now it's time to take a look at the latest stories about marijuana from news organizations across America and around the world in our normal daily audio stash, Hemp Headlines. Illinois medical marijuana bill drastically altered to suit law enforcement. Springfield, Illinois. In a press conference today, Senator John Cullerton, Democrat of Chicago, lead sponsor of a bill to protect from arrest seriously ill Illinoisans who use medical marijuana with a doctor's recommendation, announced significant changes to the legislation based on input from law enforcement. Although members of the law enforcement community have been among the most vocal opponents of the bill, Cullerton said the recent amendments reflected specific objections law enforcement officers raised in good faith in a meeting with bill proponents last month. Also at the press conference, medical marijuana activist and Chicago multiple sclerosis patient Julie Falco announced a new campaign to reach out to representatives by sending personal video appeals by seriously ill patients asking for support on the medical marijuana bill. It always seems odd when I hear about how law enforcement is involved in creating a medical marijuana law. I can't remember the last time anyone asked a panel of doctors how we should build our next prison. Nevertheless, so long as there is legal medical marijuana and illegal consumer cannabis, activists will have to walk this tightrope between caring for the needs of patients and kowtowing to law enforcement requests. Nevertheless, so long as there is legal medical marijuana and illegal consumer cannabis, activists will have to walk this tightrope between caring for the needs of patients and kowtowing to law enforcement requests. Law enforcement dislikes medical marijuana because it makes their jobs much harder. No longer can they just rip up every plant they see and arrest every person with weed they catch. There is also a strong anti-cannabis bias in law enforcement. So many officers have seen the worst narcotics and amphetamine addicts creating crime and misery, and they just lump in responsible marijuana smokers into that group. The bill has now become a pilot program with a 3-year sunset provision. So if it passes this year, activists will have to refight these battles in 2011 to keep the program. Imagine the patient who finally gets relief by using cannabis, and then after 3 years, suppose the program isn't renewed. It seems almost crueler than denying him the medicine in the first place. Possession limits have been decreased now from 12 plants and 2.5 ounces to 7 plants and 2 ounces. The bill also sets a limit of only 1,200 patients for a state that boasts a population of almost 13 million. That's less than 9 people out of every 100,000 of their population. Here in Oregon, we have about 3 million people and about 20,000 patients. That's about 666 people per 100,000 that legally can use medical marijuana. Sadly, there's over 29,000 Illinois residents every year that are diagnosed with cancer, and that is just one of the many conditions that would qualify for medical marijuana treatment under the Illinois bill. The new bill also restricts the caregiver to only one patient instead of 5, which makes me wonder, if I were an Illinois caregiver with 2 elderly patients, maybe one suffers from Alzheimer's agitation, maybe the other's going through breast cancer treatments, do I care for mom or do I care for dad? Minnesota medical marijuana bill moves forward. From KAAL-TV. Within the next week, a bill legalizing medical marijuana in Minnesota could be even closer to becoming law. The Senate has already approved the bill, and it's expected to hit the House floor in about a week. Ads are already hitting the airwaves asking the governor not to veto the bill like he's promised. Like the governor, the Minnesota Sheriff's Association and the Minnesota Chiefs of Police Association are against medical marijuana. Mower County Sheriff Teresa Amazi says, quote, "They can say they've got a prescription, but if we call the doctor, they're not going to release if they have a prescription. It becomes a HIPAA issue," end quote. Well, first of all, Sheriff, people don't get prescriptions for medical marijuana, as that would violate federal law and cause the DEA to revoke a doctor's license to prescribe scheduled drugs. But doctors are free to recommend medical marijuana, as adjudicated in the Supreme Court case Conant v. Walters. As for your so-called HIPAA issue, there is no HIPAA issue, though it's nice to see law enforcement concerned about patients' rights to privacy. Obviously, the sheriff has not read the text of the Minnesota bill, which states, "A qualifying patient who possesses a registry identification card shall not be subject to arrest, prosecution, or penalty in any manner." Registry identification card means a document issued by the commissioner that identifies a person as a qualifying patient or primary caregiver. The commissioner shall maintain a confidential list of the persons to whom the department has issued registry identification cards. The commissioner shall verify to law enforcement personnel whether a registry identification card is valid, solely by confirming the random registry identification number. In other words, Sheriff, people with medical marijuana will have a card. You won't have to call anybody about a prescription. Well, you know, this weekend is the Global Marijuana March, taking place in over 200 cities this Saturday, May 3rd. Unfortunately, it may not be taking place in one city. Brazilian court bans march for marijuana legalization. Rio de Janeiro. A Brazilian court has banned a controversial demonstration in favor of the legalization of marijuana, local media reported yesterday. The so-called Global Marijuana March, scheduled for Sunday in 10 Brazilian cities, is banned in Salvador, the capital of the Bahia state in northeastern Brazil. According to the prosecutors, the demonstration is likely to fuel controversy over marijuana smoking, currently forbidden by Brazilian law. The global march will also be held in 19 other countries. Protesters said the court's decision was absurd and has violated their freedom of speech in a struggle for a change in legislation. The demonstration was aimed at promoting public debate and research on the use of marijuana, they said. The global march has caused security concerns in Brazil. On April 21st, five people were arrested in Rio for handing out leaflets to the public, inviting local citizens to take part. Marijuana is so dangerous that now we can't even talk about it? This Brazilian court thinks that a few hundred people marching for cannabis law reform is dangerous, yet they have no problem with Carnaval, which certainly must be a bigger drain on law enforcement and definitely sends a certain message to the children, where hundreds of thousands gather in the streets at night to gawk at elaborate floats and near-naked women in extravagant outfits. If you can handle Carnaval, don't you think you can handle a marijuana march?
Marijuana is an addictive drug which produces in its users insanity, criminality, and death.
Marijuana is the most violence-causing drug in the history of mankind.
If the hideous monster Frankenstein came face to face with the monster of marijuana, he would drop dead from fright.
Prime Minister Brown says message must be sent on cannabis. London, England. Gordon Brown said on Tuesday the government needs to send a message that cannabis is unacceptable, increasing speculation he will decide to tighten drug laws. Brown has received a report from the Advisory Council on the Misuse of Drugs on cannabis and will decide soon whether to upgrade it to Class B from a Class C, although a decision is not expected this week. Newspapers have predicted that Brown will reclassify the drug, even though the council has reportedly advised the government to keep cannabis in Class C. Brown said, quote, "I don't think that the previous studies took into account that so much of the cannabis on the streets is now of a lethal quality, and we really have got to send out a message to young people. This is not acceptable," end quote. Cannabis was downgraded to Class C, which includes substances such as anabolic steroids, in 2004. That means possession of the drug is treated largely as a non-arrestable offense. But Brown launched a review by the Advisory Council, which comprises doctors, police, judges, and counselors, soon after he became Prime Minister. Yep, and now he's just about ready to completely ignore his advisory council, which is said to favor keeping cannabis decriminalized by a vote of 20-3. But surely, when someone is quoted as calling cannabis lethal, you can't expect them to accept pesky things like facts, logic, and science. Brown wants to change the cannabis laws in the UK for purely political reasons.
Hello, I'm Paul Stanford from the Hemp and Cannabis Foundation, or THCF. Medical marijuana is legal in 12 states today, and THCF has medical clinics in 6 of those states. Our physicians help qualified patients obtain an authorization for medical marijuana in their state. Patients are eligible for medical marijuana with a history of either severe chronic pain and or nausea, cancer, AIDS or HIV, hepatitis, glaucoma, seizure disorders like epilepsy, chronic muscle spasms as in multiple sclerosis or asthma, neurodegenerative diseases such as Alzheimer's, and gastrointestinal disorders like IBS or Crohn's disease. If you or someone you know has one of these conditions, our doctors will help them obtain a permit for medical marijuana. THCF Medical Clinics has offices in Washington State, Oregon, Colorado, Nevada, Hawaii, and California. Call 1-800-723-0188 or go to the web at www.hemp.org or 1-800-723-0188.
All right, we're joined today on the Daily Audio Stash by Rick Doblin, who's the president and founder of the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies, or MAPS. And Rick, welcome back to the Daily Audio Stash.
Yes, Chris. Pleasure to be back.
We bring you here on kind of a sad occasion, the death of Albert Hofmann, who was the father of LSD. And I was reading the obituary in the New York Times that he lived to be 102 years old. Tell our listeners just a little bit about Albert Hofmann and what his contribution was.
I think one of Albert's main contributions was the fact that he was the world's first LSD experience, and he demonstrated that you can have powerful experiences with LSD and remain firmly embedded within society, within your family, within your career, and that psychedelics, LSD in particular, are not necessarily a tool for the counterculture, a tool for people who inevitably run into conflicts with society, but that actually it can enhance a mainstream life. Albert was married for over 70 years. He was employed till the early 70s at Sandoz. He had a long and illustrious career there. He invented major medications, some which sold hundreds of millions of dollars a year. He retained the respect of his colleagues. He had profound mystical experiences while under the influence of LSD, and he lived what we would say would be a long and satisfying life. He was lucid up to the end. I spoke to him just a couple weeks before he died, and he was sharp, crystal clear.
Wow.
So I think what we have in Albert in his life and the way he lived it is sort of an intimation of the future, that LSD can be successfully integrated into society, into a life, and enhance our contributions. And it doesn't have to lead to social turmoil. We need to find a way to integrate, as Albert did in his own life.
Yeah, and as I was reading about Albert Hoffman, it seemed to me that his view on the psychedelic experience was that it wasn't something that was to be a recreational activity. It was something to be more spiritual and to connect one with nature.
Yeah, I would actually like to contrast, in a way, Albert's approach to LSD to Stan Grof's. And I suppose also we could add to Tim Leary,
mm-hmm.
that Albert really thought that LSD would be useful once in a decade, that you use it in large doses for spiritual inspiration, for really profound, deep experiences, and then you can spend a decade integrating that into one's normal life and one's daily consciousness. And then comes another time, new life challenges come, and another opportunity for a deep experience with LSD would be presented. That's in contrast to Stan Grof, who really focused on LSD as a tool for psychotherapy. And the religious mystical experience had a role in therapeutic outcome, but the goal was not any kind of specific religious experience, but it was just to open up to the person's unconscious and whatever level of experiences they were dealing with, personal psychodynamics. As Stan talked about, that was one level. Then there would be this sort of death-rebirth area where people confronted a lot of the existential challenges they faced surrounding their birth. And then the doorway into the transpersonal with sort of general issues of birth and death and spirituality. So Stan really could imagine and did work with some people who had 70, 80 experiences of LSD in psychotherapeutic context once every couple weeks, as contrasted to Albert's approach, you know, once or so in a decade. And then Tim Leary's approach, which was more that you didn't really need the therapeutic context or the spiritual context, but people could create their own context. And a lot of good came from that, but I think also a lot of people were unprepared for the depth and the power of the LSD experience and really hadn't been properly prepared for the struggles that really can be produced with LSD under certain circumstances. And inevitably, everybody who takes LSD will, if they take it enough, we'll get to really difficult, challenging experiences. And that's where support and therapy can really make the difference between a productive experience and one that in some ways even could be harmful.
Now, Hoffman discovered LSD quite by accident, I understand.
He didn't really accept the idea that it was completely an accident.
Okay.
It was accidental, but, you know, Albert invented LSD in 1938. It was a derivative of ergot. Semi-synthetic in a sense that there was the basic molecule came from ergot and then it was modified in the lab by Albert multiple times. LSD-25 was the 25th version of the drugs that he was testing. It was given in animals and nothing unusual was discovered and it was abandoned. And then Albert finished another line of research in 43 and was looking for something else to explore, and he said he had a peculiar presentiment that there would be something more in LSD-25. And so he resynthesized it, and he usually works, or he always worked, in extremely sterile circumstances. He worked with a lot of deadly chemicals, and yet somehow or other, he was contaminated by a bit of the LSD.
Hmm.
And this was Friday, April 16th, 1943. He felt some visual changes. He felt some flow of information in his mind, flow of imagination. And he thought maybe it had something to do with the drug that he was synthesizing. So on Monday, April 19th, 1943, he did a planned experience, and he decided to be very cautious. He would use a dose that he thought would be sub-threshold and then gradually increase it. And as it turned out, he really underestimated the incredible power of LSD. He took 250 micrograms and
oh,
had the world's first trip.
Yeah.
And in a way, that World's First trip really also sort of set the stage for the future, because he had at times terrifying experiences. He thought he was going crazy. He thought he was dying. His neighbor administered milk to him, which they thought might be an antidote, which, not surprisingly, it wasn't. And he also had beautiful moments of spiritual connection, mysticism. It reminded him of mystical experiences he had as a child, and he emerged from that experience revitalized and refreshed. He said breakfast that next morning never tasted so good, and he really saw both the risks and the benefits of LSD in his own world's first trip.
Hmm. And LSD wasn't the only psychedelic substance that he was interested in. I understand he worked with synthesizing some of the other substances.
That's true. He ended up, developing a reputation for being the father of LSD, and also he had taken it himself, as everybody knew. And so in the 1950s, when Gordon Wasson from the West discovered that Mexican and Indian shaman were still using mushrooms, various people tried to figure out what was in the mushrooms, and they couldn't do it. And they sent it off to Albert, and Albert was able to synthesize and isolate psilocybin. And the reason he was able to do that, whereas other people had failed, is that he was willing to make various fractions from the mushroom and then try them himself. And those that had activity guided him in his chemical isolation of the active properties.
Hmm.
So that the courage that Albert had to try himself, he wasn't scared of the psychedelic experience. He respected it. He wasn't scared of it. And then later he talked about it as a magic circle. He was brought morning glory seeds when it was discovered that morning glory seeds were also used for religious purposes. And there he discovered lysergic acid amide, which was very similar to LSD chemically. Not the same, not as good, nausea-producing, but similar. And so for him it was like the completion of a circle, something that he had isolated, created in a laboratory in 1938 initially, and then around 50 years later discovered, around 20 years later, I'm sorry, discovered the existence of a very similar compound in nature with a cultural use that was focused on religious and healing experiences, where he felt that LSD also had a role to play in both spirituality and psychotherapy.
And we saw that after, when we got into the 50s and 60s with the government and various researchers experimenting with LSD for both good and what we might consider bad purposes, right?
Well, for sure. I mean, the government was initially funding through National Institute of Mental Health studies. LSD led to really the whole elaboration of the serotonin system. So discovering neurotransmitters and the basic mechanisms of the brain, LSD helped in that whole intellectual process. Yet at the same time, CIA, mind control, army, military people were looking at for mind control and for interrogation purposes. And there was horrible stuff that was done by the CIA and by the military. They would set up houses of prostitution, lure people in, and then without their knowledge, dose them with LSD just to see what would happen to them.
Hmm.
And they would have two-way mirrors and people observing what was going on. In Canada, the military funded research, which was designed to kind of obliterate people's sense of self. People were kept on LSD for weeks and months at a time, and then were sort of broken down and trying to be reprogrammed, people in mental institutions. It was just horrendous, scandalous. And when that came to light, I think, as far as I can tell, that the military has not really been involved in research with psychedelics in that way. I think they discovered that they were not really useful tools for weaponization, nor were they all that helpful for interrogation. Although we do have some claims from prisoners from Guantanamo that the U.S. interrogators slipped them LSD.
Hmm.
Now, I have no idea of knowing if they actually did or what the story is there. But I think that on the one hand was sort of the above-ground research that helped illuminate the mechanisms of the mind, that helped identify the fact that psychedelics could be used in the treatment of substance abuse, of alcoholism, that psychedelics could be helpful in helping people deal with the anxiety of facing terminal illness, cancer, that it could be useful in autism. LSD actually was, in lower doses, was used in autistic kids with good effect. So we're at a situation now where actually patients with cluster headache identified for themselves that LSD and psilocybin can help abort a cluster headache attack and also can delay the recurrence of the cycle. And that's not LSD psychotherapy. That's something physiological. but it's an incredible new use for LSD and psilocybin. And I think in general, Albert's inventions and his isolation of psilocybin are going to be returning to the lab and will end up being discovered to be extremely helpful in certain circumstances. And I think will become prescription medicines with an honored place in our society, and it will have taken an initial eruption of, 30 years or so from 1938 to the 60s, and then our society really wasn't ready for it.
Yeah.
And there was all sorts of problems. People weren't really dealing with death in a very open way. The world's, the first hospice center in the United States was 1974. Birth, we were medicalizing. Women were tranquilized. Men were not allowed in the delivery room. It was all overly medicalized, and that's changed. And so I think as a society, we're also more in need of the therapeutic and healing and spiritual potential of psychedelics. And I think we also have to look at Albert Hofmann in the life that he led. He was an incredible inspiration. He continued to endorse the value of psychedelics. He talked about how he wanted to see his problem child become a wonder child, so he acknowledged the problems. But he was deeply happy. He said that the renewal of LSD research, which we were able to achieve in December, just shortly before his wife Anita died and several months before Albert died, as fulfillment of his heart's desire to see the renewal of LSD research and to see it reenter medicine. So I think that in his own life and in his writings, he was just the perfect person for LSD to have been invented by. If inventions could choose their inventors, Albert couldn't have been a better person, ideally suited for helping bring LSD into the world.
We've been speaking with Rick Doblin, who's the president and founder of the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies, or MAPS. You can check them out on the web at maps.org. Rick, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, Russ. It's been a pleasure to be here. And even though it's sad that Albert's died, it's more, as I said, a celebration of his life. He did incredible.
Well, and 102 years old, that's quite an accomplishment, too.
And married over 70 years.
Yeah. Amazing. Amazing in this time of day. Well, thank you, Rick, for talking to us today.
I smoke lots of weed, man. I plant that big old seed, man. I smoke every strain there is in town. From the super sticky green to the headache makes it brown, I smoked every strain there is around.
I know that I like it. I know that lots of people like it. So let's see what happens if you overdo it.
Do we have any pot smokers here today? Any at all?
My name is Doug Benson, and I'm about to get super high.
The term medical marijuana, you drank the Kool-Aid. Because there is no such thing as medical marijuana.
I'm going to smoke pot every day for 30 days
and try to remember to film it.
And my movie's going to be called Super High Me
or Business as Usual. I haven't decided yet on the title.
I'm going to be hospitalized, I think.
Some people call it dope. Some think it smells like burning rope. I tell you, it relieves my mind.
Here at the Normal Daily Audio Stash, we work hard to change our nation's marijuana laws through education and discussion. But we also take the time to relax and unwind with an eclectic mix of pod-safe music from many independent artists. We look for music that speaks to the growing truth about cannabis, or music that speaks to broader themes of freedom, liberty, social justice, equality, and protest. To find out more about the artists and download the music you hear on this podcast, just log on to stash.normal.org. And if you'd like to get your music heard by the online cannabis community, just send us an email at stash@normal.org. All right, welcome to Thursday, Stashers. We have a classic reggae tune from a legendary Jamaican Rasta man, Carlton Livingston. Attending school in Trenchtown, Jamaica in the 60s, Carlton honed his chops with none other than the great Bob Marley, the godfather of ganja reggae. Carlton and a schoolmate would sneak away from school to listen and sing with a yet-to-be-discovered Bob Marley and the Wailers. Recording music throughout the 70s and in the 80s, Carlton gained a faithful following of reggae fans. His longevity in the business has finally landed Carlton the title of one of the top songwriters in Jamaica. Today's track, 100 Pound Collie Weed, came from a 1992 recording session on Long Island, New York, after he had moved to the U.S.
You can learn more about Carlton Livingston by clicking the links at our blog, stash.normal.org, where you can also get an MP3 download of this song. This is Carlton Livingston with 100 Pound Collie Weed.
Get hustling, get hustling,
oh yeah.
Get hustling, get hustling. With a 100 weight of Cali weed coming from center,
center.
A 100 weight of Cali weed coming from center,
center.
The speed limit was 35, was doing 55. See a Babylon child drop out on me, on me. We start to speed on corners, just like we are daredevil. You couldn't keep up with me, cause me too hard, me too hard. With a 100 weight of Cali weed coming from center,
center.
A 100 weight of Cali weed coming from center,
center.
Can't afford to get arrested, arrested, arrested. Lord, I don't have no papers on me, on me. Can't deal with no time, don't a GP, GP. I've got to make a clean break. Can't take no check now, with a 100 weight of Cali weed coming from center,
center.
A 100 weight of Cali weed coming from center,
center.
The cops, they set up a roadblock, roadblock. And man, you know, I just can't stop, can't stop. The cops, they start to chase, bust up some shot, some shot. But man, I've got to make it away, away. With a 100 weight of Cali weed coming from center,
center.
100 weight of Cali weed coming from center,
center.
The dreadlocks are waiting in the city, the city. Just to get my jaw, me hurt. Man, I see the flashing lights coming, coming. Now tell me now, tell me now what I'm gonna do.
Almost busted in Laredo, but for reasons that I'd rather not disclose.
I smoke pot, and I like it a lot. Hi, this is Willie Nelson. I learned a long time ago that marijuana is a lot safer to use than alcohol. There's absolutely nothing wrong with the responsible use of marijuana by adults. It's time we stopped arresting and started respecting responsible marijuana smokers in America. And to learn what you can do to help, please contact Normal at www.norml.org or call toll-free at 888-67-NORMAL.
The show was long and we were just sitting there, and we'd come to play and not just for the ride.
Well, for some more cannabis science here on the Daily Audio Stash, we're joined by a doctoral student of Dr. Mitch Earlywine's. This is Nicholas Van Dam, who's joining us by telephone today. Nicholas, thanks for joining us.
It's great to be here.
Now, you had just gotten a paper published on polydrug use, cannabis, and psychosis-like symptoms. This was in the Journal of Human Psychopharmacology. And you came to a very interesting result. Dr. Earlywine and I talk a lot about these studies that say that smoking marijuana is going to cause schizophrenia and psychosis. And well, tell our listeners what you discovered in your research.
Sure, I'd be happy to. So there's been a lot of hype recently over a publication that came out in The Lancet. And basically what a lot of people have wanted to say is that the use of cannabis leads to an increased risk of developing psychosis. And the problem, of course, is that once the individual has developed full-blown psychosis, the things that lead up to it are sort of hard to tease out. So what we've done is, in order to sort of sidestep those issues, we've looked at schizotypal personality disorder. And what that is it's a it's a symptom or a disorder that actually precedes schizophrenia.
Okay, so it's not the full-blown schizophrenia.
Right. So basically a number of individuals who have this disorder are much more likely to go on than to develop schizophrenia. And so in looking at this sort of preceding syndrome, we're able to look at individuals who have a higher risk but don't have all the factors associated with schizophrenia. So in the past, individuals have found, researchers have found that the use of cannabis is highly associated with increased scores on a measure of schizotypy. And the problem has been that basically they haven't controlled for the use of other drugs. So they're finding this big effect, and they're saying that, you know, individuals have increased schizotypy as a result of cannabis use, but then they're not considering the fact that individuals who are using a large amount of cannabis potentially are using other drugs as well.
Does this include, are we talking just the typical illicit drugs, or are we also including alcohol in that equation?
Sure, we're also considering alcohol, caffeine, and nicotine.
Okay.
And in fact, some researchers have actually found that the use of alcohol and nicotine can predict symptoms of schizotypy as well. Both alone and in combination with the use of marijuana.
Hmm.
So there's certainly some interactions going on here. Our study in particular, we didn't find any useful predictions associated with the use of legal drugs, but we did find that when you control for the use of other drugs, so we're talking about cocaine and amphetamines, methamphetamine, and ecstasy, things of that nature, you actually see a decline in the ability of marijuana use to actually predict the development or the symptoms of schizotypy.
Okay, so marijuana use by itself, then, if we can summarize this, isn't an accurate predictor of whether someone will have schizotypal syndromes.
Right. So what the conclusion that we made was that basically marijuana is more strongly associated with other drug use in individuals who have schizotypy. So individuals who use lots of different drugs have a higher risk of developing schizotypal personality disorder than just individuals who use marijuana. And in fact, one of the ways that we broke down the groups was we looked at individuals who only use legal drugs, so caffeine, nicotine, and alcohol, and individuals who use cannabis and legal drugs. And then we had an additional group where we looked at people who used legal drugs and all kinds of other illicit drugs. And we found that there was essentially no difference between individuals who use marijuana and legal drugs and individuals who use only legal drugs.
Hmm.
So it seems like individuals who use marijuana with legal drugs really don't have the types of symptomatology that's associated with using lots of different drugs. And in those individuals, it's where the schizotypal symptoms are really showing up.
Now, isn't another problem in trying to determine the effects of cannabis in schizotypal disorders the fact that it's hard to tell whether someone is using cannabis to self-medicate the disorder that they already had? Is there a way of controlling for that?
Right, and that's certainly an issue that a lot of researchers in this area have brought up. There's really not a good way of controlling for that. One of the prominent researchers in this area has made a statement indicating that it's very possible that individuals may, in fact, go on to develop schizophrenia, and the whole time they may have been using substances to deal with negative symptoms that are associated with their condition prior to actually developing it in a full-blown fashion. And unfortunately, there's really not a good way for us to look at that unless we do longitudinal studies where we take individuals who don't have any of the symptoms and follow them over a long period of time and then potentially see who develops the full-blown psychosis. Again, there the problem is also that with those individuals, we can't necessarily know ahead of time what their symptoms were or are going to be. Mm-hmm. So there's really no good way to control for that factor.
Are there any other difficulties you found in putting together this study?
Sure. Well, some of the issues arise with approaching individuals who may have these sorts of symptoms. Certainly, one issue is that some of the individuals who have symptoms of schizotypy may be reluctant to admit to them. And so the method that we used was through an internet survey. And we actually found, and there's some research on this as well, that individuals are more willing to openly admit to illicit substance use as well as some of the more deviant symptoms of schizotypy when they respond in this fashion. And so compared to some previous studies that have looked at similar things, we hope that we have a more accurate estimate of the actual symptoms and the actual listed substance use as a result of people being more willing to openly admit to things like this.
So that would be a benefit of taking the anonymous internet survey, but doesn't that run the risk of the problem of having a self-selected sample?
Sure, it certainly does. And to whatever extent we can, we've screened our data as best for any fraudulent entries and things of that nature. But we can't know for sure that our sample is not self-selected. But when looking at the data, we do have enough of a range in responses and a range in the scores in schizotypy and amongst drug use that we feel fairly confident that we have a wide variety of individuals. Now, certainly, we don't know that we're adequately representing everyone because there are groups of individuals who, as you know, don't have access to computers. And there are some individuals who are so impaired that they may not be able to take a computer questionnaire. But we don't make any attempt to generalize to those individuals.
I see. Now, just for our listeners who may not have a full understanding of the medical differences, and this doesn't have to be a huge medical dissertation or anything, but what are some of the symptoms or the effects of the schizotypy? What type of behaviors are we talking about here?
Sure. So schizotypal personality disorder is sort of a something that it's similar to schizophrenia, but you don't have the impairment that you would with full-blown schizophrenia. So you have things like bizarre thoughts and some bizarre sensations and disorganized feelings and symptoms in your daily life, but you don't have the full-blown hallucinations and depression. So someone with schizophrenia, for instance, may hear voices. Someone with schizotypal personality disorder may just be more sensitive to sounds. So they may think they're hearing a beeping noise when they don't, for instance, or they may be someone who's perceived as eccentric. And one of the primary distinctions is that it doesn't necessarily impact their lives in a negative way. So someone with a personality disorder can often still continue to function if, from their perspective effectively, while others around them may recognize that there could potentially be something going on.
It's very interesting research. And so can we summarize this by telling Prime Minister Gordon Brown up there in England that the dreaded skunk cannabis isn't going to cause psychosis and schizophrenia in the youths of Britain?
I certainly wish I could, and if I could talk to him, I'd be one of the first to call him up. Dr. Earlywine and I have been discussing that a little bit, and it's certainly there's been not a whole lot of evidence that the content of THC in marijuana is changing and changing rapidly, nor that it's as big a threat as we'd like to think it is, or at least our policymakers like to think it is. But unfortunately, over the years, these studies continue to come out that say things like ours do, and we turn around and the next study that comes out is someone else saying they have a correlation between marijuana use and schizophrenia, and then, you know, of course, the administration is more likely to accept the findings that already support what the policies they have in place. So yeah. I fear that Ron may want to distance himself further from the Bush administration rather than accepting anything that researchers like Dr. Erlewine and I have to say.
Well, yeah, and the media is not much help either. You know, as soon as there's a positive study on medical marijuana or the effects of marijuana, it's buried. But as soon as there's one, like you said, that exacerbates the reefer madness lies, those get, you know, front page headlines and top of the news stories. So it's a tough battle, but we thank people like you who are helping to come up with the scientific research to make the points. We've been speaking with doctoral student Nicholas Van Dam from the State University of New York at Albany. Thanks for joining us, Nicholas. Appreciate your time.
Thank you for downloading the Normal Daily Audio Stash, the growing truth about cannabis. We are produced by the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws in Washington, D.C. Our executive producer is Alan St. Pierre. Our deputy director is Paul Armentano. Our webmaster is Brian Judy. And web production is provided by Red Aphid Interactive Media. As always, you can catch up on the latest information about marijuana at www.norml.org. And you can interact and download from our Audio Stash blog at stash.normal.org. For everyone here at Normal, I'm your host, Radical Russ Belville, hoping all your harvests are bountiful and your encounters with law enforcement are non-existent.
I leave you today with another cannabis quote, this time from Alexander Bickel, a constitutional scholar, who said, quote, "We cannot, by total reliance on law, escape the duty to judge right and wrong. There are good laws, and there are occasionally bad laws, and it conforms to the highest traditions of a free society to offer resistance to bad laws and to disobey them," end quote. Yes, and the prohibition of cannabis is one of those bad laws. We will continue to resist it in every way we can, especially this weekend at the Global Marijuana March. I'm Radical Russ. Thanks for tuning in to the Daily Audio Stash. Until next time, take care of each other, tokers.